Duncan, do you know what I think about when I think about injustice?
What do you think about?
I think about the fact that there are people who are listening to this podcast who haven't liked, subscribed, or left a five-star review.
Even though they can do that on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, whatever platform they prefer.
Wherever they get their podcasts. And yet, somehow, they haven't done that. It just makes me so cross.
A real injustice.
Welcome to A Pod Too Far, the home of proper war movies like they used to make in the olden days. Today, we have a story of podcasting. The heroes are the host, and the only villain is the internet. The cruel internet that man has made more cruel. That's right, we're watching The Cruel Sea. I'm Rob Hutton, and I've joined this podcast eager to do my bit. With me is a man who seems decent enough, but is haunted by a terrible choice in his past that turned him into a mass killer. Hello, Duncan Weldon.
Hello, Rob.
How many times have you seen The Cruel Sea?
I have seen The Cruel Sea, at least 8 or 9, possibly double. This may have tipped me into double figures. And in fact, I'll be honest, I have watched it twice ahead of this.
So have I, for various reasons. Yeah. It's good. So when do you think you first saw it?
I first saw this one when I was very young, definitely in the 1980s. The first time I remember specifically sitting down to watch it out of choice, I would have been 15 or 16.
Yeah.
And by that point, I had probably already seen it 2, maybe 3 times.
I think similarly, I think this is one that I absorbed in pieces. So for instance, the Asdic training, I have a very vivid memory of seeing the Asdic training scene while round at a friend's house years and years ago. But this might have actually been the first time I've sat down and watched it from beginning to end.
Really?
Yeah, I don't know, because I think it's
You've never been in the Royal Navy, have you?
I've never been in the Royal Navy. No one in my family's been in the Royal Navy. And yeah, I think it's slightly sort of merged in my mind with the Battle of the Plate and In Which We Serve. And in fact, I thought that the Aztec training scene was in Which We Serve. The moment at which I realised that was definitely The Cruel Sea was when we watched In Which We Serve.
Yeah. We have done a lot of 1950s black and white Royal Navy movies.
We have, and okay, let's compare this, because this is the third of, I would say, the sort of the archetype Royal Navy films. It's not as cheery as the Battle of the River Plate. Rather more complex than In Which We Serve.
Yes.
I think, although In Which We Serve, you know, they get sunk.
But this is the one, apparently, I'm told, beloved of the Royal Navy today, where ships will have cruel seas nights, where they splash water on each other at different times in the film, etc. You know,
yes,
people in the Navy love this film, apparently.
I was hoping you would bring that up. Yes, it's a sort of very wet drinking game. Mm-hmm. Jack Hawkins versus Noel Coward.
I'm gonna go with Hawkins. I'm gonna go with Hawkins. I mean, I really do think In Which We Serve is a fantastic film, but I also think this is a different film. But Hawkins beats Coward, and it's a more convincing.
It's much more convincing as a grizzled. Although I was reading, I was doing lots of research on this one. I was reading something at Hawkins' sort of memoirs about making this morning, and he said he was a very emotional actor. He was always crying and things, and there's a part of him that slightly resents the fact that his great role is one where essentially he just sort of sits there with his chin stuck out, taking it all.
Yeah.
But actually, I think one of the things that makes this film work is sort of the fact that these are men who you sense that they're not just archetypes. So I think originally they were looking at having Stanley Baker playing what became the Donald Sinden role. And Sinden for the sort of the first lieutenant. And at some point in casting, they realised, and I just think that's the right decision.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
Because Sinden has got a softness to him.
Yeah.
And it's that softness hardening, which is basically, this is the story of men going to war and being sort of corrupted by it.
Yeah.
Do you have a lot of Donald Sinden memories?
Not a huge amount, to be honest. Not a huge amount.
I was trying to think what else I'd seen him. Did you ever watch Never the Twain?
I don't think I did.
To me, he's the guy from The Cruel Sea, not yeah.
He was voted in the 1950s the man that women would most like to see across the breakfast table.
Tremendous. And a very 1950s way of phrasing the poll.
But that's a very specific thing, because that's not, you know, that's Sean Connery might be the man you'd like to see in other circumstances, but the sort of the thought that Donald Sinden was sitting there, you know, with the cornflakes, it's sort of like, yeah, okay, you know, he'll probably be home for tea as well. Also, I think I Sinden more in his sort of 80s caricature role. He was a puppet on Spitting Image.
Was he?
He was. It's a great Spitting Image sketch where he goes to a restaurant and he says to the waiter, "Do you serve a ham salad?" And they say, "We serve anyone salads." Which tells you very much how Don Sinden was viewed by the 1980s. Yes. But that's harsh. The other really important fact in relation to Donald Sinden, in relation to this film, is he has negative buoyancy.
Oh, now I have heard about this. Now, I don't know the full details, but yeah, negative buoyancy.
I didn't know this was something that people could have.
Oh, I sometimes fear I have it. I think I've managed to overcome it. But yes, some people don't float. And when you tell your swimming teacher, "I just don't float," they don't believe you, Rob. They don't believe you. Right. So this is a real thing, though. But yeah, if you had negative buoyancy and you had not strived, as some of us have, to overcome it, one might question the decision to be in a film set at sea involving scenes filmed presumably in some sort of tank with you in the water.
So the crucial diving into the water scene was filmed in Ealing Studios, apparently had a big tank. And they'd said to him, "Can you swim?" And he'd said no. But they had assumed that you know,
health and safety was very different in the early 50s.
Well, so different that apparently they film it and then Jack Hawkins says, "Where's Donald?" They realise that he's still under the water because he dived in and he hadn't come up. So that was when they learned that he had negative buoyancy. And so in the bit where he's swimming, apparently he's actually, there is somebody underneath him who is doing the swimming. I read that and I watched it again and he says, "You can see," and I couldn't see, I have to say, but...
Tremendous.
Yeah, so this is the beginning of a little Donald Sinden run. He's off to do, you know, sort of in Doctor in the House and that kind of thing. And you can completely see why from this.
Yeah.
And whereas Stanley Baker is a more conventional sort of war hero type.
Yeah.
Actually, he's perfect to be a bullying first lieutenant. He's still not even a supporting man at this point. I think Hell Drivers is his breakthrough film, and that's a couple of years away. Yeah. But have you read the book, The Cruel Sea?
I've read an extract from The Cruel Sea, which you very kindly sent to me the other day. I mean, I hadn't actually realised until we were doing it for this that it was based on a book. It's sort of a memoir, is it, by a...
Book by a chap called Nicholas Montserrat, who is now, I mean, as is so many authors, now sort of forgotten. But this is the thing. Except weirdly, Wikipedia says he's remembered for something else. It's like, no, he's remembered for The Cruel Sea.
And it's very immediately post-war, isn't it?
Yes. Well, because this film is this film is out in 53.
Yeah.
This is basically his war. So he starts on a corvette and he finishes on a frigate. And if you think this is bleak, the book is bleaker. If people don't want to read it, if you find the We Have Ways podcast Christmas episodes from a couple of years ago, if you just search for The Cruel Sea.
Yeah.
You will hear Al Murray reading a chapter of it, the 1942 chapter, and it is beautifully read and also incredibly bleak. It's a series of anecdotes about times that they found dead people in the water, basically.
Classic Christmas episode fodder, it must be said.
I mean, it's great, but also you sort of... I mean, I think we'll come back to this point, but reading sort of Montserrat's Wikipedia page and his obituary, you thought, gosh, it sounds like quite a hard man. And then you read what happened to him and you think, okay, fair enough, you can be a hard man. I bet you're entitled to be difficult. 6 years of this, you can be as difficult as you like. The screenplay is by Eric Ambler. You an Eric Ambler fan?
Not a huge one. Are you?
Again, so I think of Eric Ambler as a novelist.
Yep.
Arguably invents the modern spy novel. He's one of the three or four you'd have in the mix for that. Yeah. But actually, he's written some well-selling spy novels before the war. including Journey into Fear, which I can still imprint and I can recommend, and joins the war as a private, joins the Royal Artillery, and then is moved fairly swiftly over to the Army Film and Photographic Unit.
Yeah.
Do you know about the Army Film and Photographic Unit?
Are they doing all the fun propagandary type things?
Yeah, but they're in with the troops. They're casual. Yeah. They've got about a 30% casualty rate.
Yeah.
It's quite shocking, actually. Because you think, oh, well, that sounds like it. That sounds like
a
lot.
That lark for the war.
You see how many of them died. Yeah. And you think, okay, that was actually probably quite hairy.
Yeah.
Because they go in with the commandos. They go in the first wave on D-Day.
I know it's American, but you look at those Frank Capra D-Day pictures, you know, the classic picture of, like, you know, the front coming down of the landing craft.
He insisted on being in the first wave, Frank Capra. Eric Adler finishes the war as a lieutenant colonel. And actually, if you sort of look at what he did, he probably wrote more screenplays than novels. He wrote The Way Ahead, which we will definitely do.
Yeah.
He also wrote The Yangtze Incident, which one of our listeners, Keith Fitzpatrick, has requested that we do, but we have to find it first.
Yes.
But I was interested to see that, and we will try to get to that. So 1953 for war movies. I was looking this morning at...
This is the big post-war swing of making the first great generation of war movies in Britain.
With the caveat that the source of this is Wikipedia, this is war movies released each year after the war. 1946, 5, 1947, 2, 1948, 3, 1949, 6. So not many. Mm-hmm. 1958, 1951, 13. 1952, 9. 1953, 18.
There we go.
And also this year we have the Desert Rats.
Yeah, so the Marvel universe of its day.
Yeah.
In the early 50s,
well, they just realised. We will come on to the failure of film studios to realise what a rich seam this was. But also 1953, we have the Desert Rats. Also 1953, we have Stalag 17.
Yeah.
Which we will be doing next week, in fact. But the biggest film of the year in the UK is The Cruel Sea.
Yeah.
And it, unusually for a British war film, it does well in the United States too.
In which we served did well everywhere. Yeah.
I mean, everyone loved it.
Yeah. And that must have been about a decade before this.
It's released 42, so it's 11 years before this. I mean, you couldn't have made this during the war.
Oh, no, this is very different.
Exactly what the status of the censorship was, I don't know, but... They were never going to let this one out. It's an Ealing Studios film. It's the one that Michael Balcon, I think, said he was probably proudest of.
Really?
It was the one where basically everything worked.
Yeah.
And I think that's the thing. You know, when you do anything creative, there's a sort of, you're sitting there going, you look at, I wish we'd done something. And that was the one where we thought, actually, do you know what? We landed that one.
Yeah.
It is simultaneously a very bleak film, and then you... Every time you find anything else about the book, you think, oh my goodness, they really toned it down. And again, it's interesting because you've got all of this class stuff going on.
Yes. Yes.
So you've got Denham Elliott is a barrister, you know, quite posh.
Yeah.
Donald Sinden's a journalist and they're not necessarily posh by any means, but Montserrat was, his father was a surgeon or something. So Montserrat, who is the basis of the Donaldson character, definitely was posh. Whereas Stanley Baker, who's, you know, the first lieutenant and commanding them, they're all laughing that he's a secondhand car salesman.
This is very much, you know, it's part of the genre almost of these British war films as well, isn't it? There's a lot of class in them.
I mean, the straightforward sort of the working class are below decks and the officer class are the officer class thing, which we had in which we serve, is absolutely sort of maintained.
But then within that, there's also, the professional middle class versus commercial versus, proper poshers.
They found a genuine flower class corvette to make it. You might actually know the name of the ship.
I don't. So where did they find it? Because I thought they were all... I mean, so just for people that aren't familiar with corvettes, corvettes are smaller than frigates. For people that don't know what a frigate is either, a corvette is
Why don't we do the biggest is an aircraft carrier?
Yeah, biggest aircraft carrier. Then you've got a battleship. Then you've got a cruiser. Then you've got a destroyer. Then a frigate. And then a corvette. So corvettes, it's a big ship if you saw it on a lake, but it's not a big ship in naval terms. It's commanded by a lieutenant rather than a captain. Although just really confusingly to, confuse non-naval people, you would often refer to that lieutenant as captain whilst they were
while
on the ship.
Captaining.
Whilst he was captaining the ship, but his rank would be lieutenant.
And they're all reservists in this.
Yeah.
So none of them are professional sailors.
Yeah. And this is not a this is not a ship you want to put sort of in a battle against an enemy surface ship. You know, what these things were used for was sort of shepherding around convoys, trying to protect against submarines. That's their men.
It's got one gun. And I mean, you know, depth charge capacity and so on. But it's a small ship. So and they're all broken up after the war. They find one in a breaker's yard in Malta.
Oh wow!
Which had been used by the Greek Navy, and the Royal Navy sailors said the Greeks had terribly abused it. They couldn't understand. They couldn't understand what they'd done to it. So it's HMS Coreopsis.
Okay.
I think plays the Compass Rose, and they use. I mean, this is the other thing that I think is really interesting ethically. Mm-hmm. They use real wartime footage. So especially in the sort of the final bit, the Arctic convoy, you see footage of a plane being shot down and crashing into the sea. And that's real footage of a plane being shot down and crashing into the sea.
Now, see, it's interesting, isn't it? Because if you were a director today making a film in, 2023 about the war in Afghanistan?
Yeah.
I mean, I can't imagine you're going to put in, you know, some CNN footage of a helicopter going down.
Yeah, you know, that was a man dying there for real. You know, and they've got it's real footage of ship. Not all the ships exploding is real footage, but some of the ships exploding is.
And this is only 8 years after the war. I mean, you know, this is 1953. I mean, it is the equivalent of using real combat footage from 2015 and the rise of IS in Iraq and Syria and putting that in a film today. I mean, it
is 8 years after the war. The book has been a huge hit. Despite the fact that the book is grim, and the film is a huge hit, despite the fact that the film is grim, which I guess tells us, again, something about how we're relating to this.
Yes. And as you know, you've already said, but it's a very different film to In Which We Serve. Which is a film, you know, I mean, Which We Serve, and when we discussed it, we said, you know, is it a propaganda film? Does it matter? It's a great piece of cinema. This isn't a propaganda film. It's a film which shows the Royal Navy and these Royal Naval Reservists in a very good light, of course. You know, they're the heroes of it, but it's a far grimmer film in many ways.
It's also, at the end, you know, the bit where they are hauling the German sailors in, and one of them, you know, a British sailor hauls this submariner in, and this U-boat man in, and says, you're all right now, you're safe now.
Yeah.
And there's a whole... why ultimately are we fighting our fellow humans? You know, why are we doing this? Yeah. And it's not an anti-war film. It's a war is hell film.
Yes.
It's a war is hell, and war is hell fought between people just like us, and he doesn't want to be there and I don't want to be here. And I mean, compare it to the Battle of the River Plate, which is not long after this, which is all very jolly. And, you know, I mean, again, actually, the German in the Battle of the River Plate is a perfectly decent chap. He's not a U-boat captain, of course.
No.
Shall we go to the after-action report?
Let's go for it.
The first question is how we feel about... the structure of it is episodic.
Yeah.
The book is episodic. The book is basically a series of sections, one section for each year, and then I think chapters within those. And the film basically takes that. You can sort of see where the years are. And I think it's 4 or 5 missions. I was trying to work it out. I think I may have merged a couple of the Atlantic runs in my mind. But do you think that works?
I do. So you sort of get the course of the war almost. Mm. You know, it's noticeable, you know, at the start, sort of the enemy is the sea.
Yeah.
You know, rough seas in the Atlantic, all of this. And, you know, it's not until after it's not until after the Germans have taken over France. That, you know, they've got access to these sort of French bases. You can get Germans operating far further out in the Atlantic. You still see Germans appearing. Get with the Arctic convoys. I think this sort of almost episodic structure, it works for the film. It doesn't feel too disjointed.
No. I mean, and also the Jack Hawkins narration. I mean, I'm not a fan of narration in films. I generally think if you're narrating, you failed as a
screenwriter. Yeah, but it didn't need... I think the narration was needed structurally here, but it's not that sort of, you know, expositional narration you'd get if this film was made today, where the audience probably wouldn't be as familiar with you know, the course of the Battle of the Atlantic.
Yeah, that's true. So, quick dad, they're on the cable car. I mean, of the runs, there is the first proper Atlantic run where we see Sindon doing his medical officer, becoming hardened.
Yeah.
Again, you just want to listen to the 1942 thing where he's describing, and again, you'd think this must be something that Monster had experienced, where he's describing sponging down a burned sailor with a tiny tube of, you know, burn medicine that's designed for children. And every time he swabs him, the flesh comes off and he's just praying for the man to die.
Yeah.
We get a sense of just that hardening that is happening in Sindon. And again, that's the moment I thought Stanley Baker, great actor that he is, would have been wrong for this, because he starts hard. There's the Gibraltar run.
Yeah.
The Gibraltar run is the thing that people talk about. Now, I have some questions. My first question actually is, when somebody comes and says they get a signal from the Admiralty that there are indications of 5 U-boats in your area.
Yeah.
Do we think this is ultra? Is that what we're supposed to think?
Yeah, it's ultra. But obviously you couldn't talk about that in the 50s.
Well, they wouldn't have known. I mean, Montserrat would not have, out on the ship, would not have had the first idea, but they would have got that message.
Yes.
You know, right. So this is an early movie appearance of ultra.
Yes, yes.
With the entire cast unaware.
Yes.
I think that they do the silence incredibly. Every time they have to stop, you can get the nervousness.
Yeah.
All of that's done. And then we get this choice. There are sailors in the water. They think that underneath the sailors is a U-boat.
And this to me is the great moment. And this was filmed multiple times, as I understand, as well, through several edits.
The reaction is, the scene itself.
Yeah.
Well, actually, so in the film,
yeah,
the crucial decision that Hawkins has to make is, does he rescue the men or does he try to sink the U-boat?
Yes.
And he tries to sink the U-boat, and you don't see it in the film, but again, in the book, it's absolutely clear that if you drop a depth charge underneath men in the water,
men
in the water die, and they don't die nicely.
Yes, yes.
You know, and Hawkins is destroyed by this, you know, and in the film, it's left open that there might have been a U-boat down there.
Yeah.
In the book, it's clear that actually what they were picking up is the sinking ship that the U-boat had hit. So that was the signal they were getting from under the water. And so it was all horribly in vain.
I think it's a great moment. And you get a real sense of the anguish of the decision that has been made. You know, we spoke about hardening processes, all of that. I mean, this is the hard bit. You know, you think you're making this choice. Am I going to kill these fellow countrymen? Well, Merchant Navy guys, aren't they?
Yeah. They're supposed to be protecting. That's the whole reason they're there, to keep these guys
safe. And you're making a decision, am I going to kill them with this depth charge, but hopefully that will destroy the submarine, which is a threat to the rest of the convoy. But it's not an easy decision, and I think it's just a great cinematic moment watching the anguish as that decision is made and the reaction. But you'll know more than me, but as I understand it, they went through several different edits.
Hawkins films the scene with Sindon where they're talking about whether they did the right thing. And Sindon says, it's my fault, I'm the murderer. And Hawkins says, no one murdered them. It's the war, a whole bloody war. We've just got to do these things and say our prayers at the end. Yeah. And he does it. And the first time he does it, he's crying because he feels this. Because as I say, actually, Hawkins is a deeply emotional actor.
Yeah.
And a couple of days later, he sees sort of Michael Balcon come on set. Balcon's the producer, but also he's quite an interventionist producer.
Yeah. Yeah.
And Balcon says, I just think it's too emotional. I've watched the cut. Can you do it? Can you do it without tears? So they go and they film it again. And then a couple of days later, Balcon comes back and says, could you do it with tears? And they each time they say, right, we think we've got it.
Yeah.
And actually, when he watches the final cut, Hawkins is quite pleased to see the first one is the one. But
it works. It's great. It's not a call someone in for moment, but it's a great bit of cinema.
Yeah. Yeah. And everything about it, the sort of the tenderness between these two men. I mean, there's a really interesting line later on where the Wren, Virginia McKenna, that Sindon is sort of fallen in love with, talks about the friendship between Donaldson and Jack Hawkins and says, women don't have these kinds of friendships. And you think, right, that's a strange, you know, in 2023, we're in an endless debate about what does male friendship look like and all of this kind of thing. But that must have felt true to be written in at some point.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a lovely moment of tenderness.
Yeah.
Then on the return from the jib run, actually, the bit that I just thought was so well done was the repair, where they sort of have to stop,
yeah,
do a repair, and no one's to make any sound. And it's done without music. Yeah. There's no, you know, sort of nervous violins or anything. Yeah. And you just have lots and lots of scenes of men trying to be quiet.
Yes.
You know, yes. And listening to one man hammering loudly.
Yes. Yeah, that's one of the best lines, I think, you know. Is it loud? You both are complaining about the racket sort of thing. Yeah.
But I thought, does this film do Terrified Silence as well as King Rat does Hunger?
Yeah, but it possibly does. Possibly does. And yeah, it's that whole context, isn't it? That, you know, these U-boats are under the sea, they're listening. Yeah. It's about, can they hear you?
And you're in a tiny little Corvette, which, if it is hit by a torpedo, is going straight down.
Yeah.
Which brings us to the next sort of key sequence, which is the sinking of the Compass Rose.
Yes.
Which sort of feels, you know, by the standards of 1950s action movies.
All very plausibly done.
Apart from Donald Sinden's swimming.
That's probably the scene I actually do want to be called in for. Yeah. Now I know there's a man underneath
him. Yeah, right. Let's see if we can spot the man. Right side of melodrama, all of that?
I think just about. You know, in the context of 1950s cinema, it's not, you know.
So, first of all, back in port, before this run, the sort of the key setup is that three of the men have experienced tragedy. The sort of the chief engineer and his mate have lost the woman that they both love. And Denham Elliot has realized that his wife is cheating on him.
Yeah.
And those are the men that we see die.
Yeah.
I think we're supposed to think they've just given up.
Yeah.
You know, they are succumbing to the icy depths. But there's other interesting stuff as well. So one of the other officers has a breakdown on the boat.
Yeah.
I mean, I think this film is really interesting about mental health.
Yeah. And yeah, it wouldn't have been spoken about in those terms, but I think there is a recognition that, you know, for these guys on these small boats that have been doing this for 4, 5 years, 6 years by this point, end of the war, this is quite a trying time mentally. And yeah, I think the film, you know, you've got that gap of 8, 9 years after the war, you can look back and say, you know, this was fairly hellish.
Well, so one of my theories is that after the war, we have a generation of men wandering around with undiagnosed PTSD.
Yeah. That sounds quite plausible.
You know, and I have an extended theory about all of this because they all go home to homes that don't know them and to children that don't know them.
Yeah.
And, you know, my father basically didn't meet his father before he was 5 years old.
Yeah.
And
what
does that do to a family? And this film actually is one of the earliest films I've seen, I think, there's a later scene where we see, you know, Hawkins having a traumatic flashback episode when he's, in fact, flashing back to this and remembering it. And there would definitely have been people watching this for whom, well, these days we would say, well, this is very triggering. I mean, these days, if you had, you know, as it were, if you'd had a friend who had been out in Afghanistan in the worst of it, I'm not sure that you would necessarily say, hey, you need to come and see this film where Mark Wahlberg's in Afghanistan in the worst of it.
Yeah.
Whereas obviously, I wonder, I mean, do we think that all these guys were going to see it because in a way it was a way of dealing with it?
I suspect so. You know, it was very popular, wasn't it? I mean,
it was very popular.
The Navy seems to have embraced it very early as well.
Yeah, the Navy, I mean, I'm really interested that the Navy still love it.
Yeah.
And I think that must be because, in a sense, this is the thing that captures what it's like.
Yes.
What you need to prepare yourself for. While the lieutenant is having a breakdown on the boat, there is a moment where he says, and this is just interesting because it's sort of what Montserrat and Ambler are willing to talk about, where he's talking about his wife. He's having a breakdown. He says, we can't get rid of it. We can't.
Yeah.
And I'm assuming that's talking about an abortion.
Yes, presume so.
Yeah. And again, that's just not something that is being dealt with in 1950s cinema explicitly. And it really is a blink and you'll miss it moment.
Yes.
On the other raft, we have Jack Hawkins, who I think might be the world's worst quizmaster. Would you want to go to a pub quiz with Jack Hawkins? Yes, that's right. Everybody clap. Come on, clap.
No, I don't think I would. I mean, you've got to pass the time somehow in that situation. I mean, you know, needs must.
I think it is sort of touching all of that, you know, with Sinden trying to get the men to sing Under the Spreading Chestnut. Yeah. Come on, do the actions, everyone. You know, it's a sort of desperate need to keep people awake and keep them moving and all of this kind of thing. All of that.
I mean, I can't imagine much worse than being in that situation. But then I suppose, you know, an enforced sing-along is probably the one thing that would really tip me over the edge.
Actually, I might just dive into the water and think about my unfaithful wife. Yeah. and then really, we've got the Arctic Convoy.
Yeah.
There's good stuff in there.
Oh, there is. There is. There is.
The fact that Hawkins basically says everything changed after Compass Rose.
Yeah.
There are so many great quotes in this, but it's getting to be a different kind of war.
Yeah.
The people in it have got different too. Now the war doesn't seem to be a matter of feelings anymore. All that finished with Compass Rose. Now it's just a matter of killing the enemy.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, that's explaining why he doesn't want to get close to people anymore.
Yeah.
Except to Sindon, who he's already got close to.
Yeah.
I mean, I think it's the Gibraltar run is the best bit, isn't it?
Right. I think that is actually going back to your point about the narrative structure of the film. I think the one thing when I think about it, which maybe does suffer from the episodic nature, is the climax doesn't quite work as a climax. You know, some of the best, most dramatic moments happen, so what, two-thirds of the way in?
Well, let's talk about this. Partly this is because by the time that these guys are doing the Arctic convoys, which granted, the Arctic convoys were, I believe, hellish.
Yeah.
The Navy has kind of started to work out how to deal with submarines, hasn't it?
Yes, yes.
Have you read a book by Simon Parkin called The Game of Birds and Wolves?
I haven't.
Which is about, you will like it, actually, because it's about war games. They used war games to work out how anti-submarine tactics.
Yes.
And the argument basically is that, sort of by 43, 44, they're just much, much better. It's become more dangerous for the U-boats.
The casualty rate in the U-boat service is absolutely horrific. It's the highest in the Wehrmacht. It's I'll get it slightly wrong, but it's something in the region of 80, 85%.
This is the Phillips O'Brien point.
Yeah.
Phillips O'Brien, for listeners who don't know, is a great academic of military strategy and historian and so on. And he has got some terrific, provocative lines, including the idea that Enigma might actually have lengthened the war because the Royal Navy is using it to avoid U-boats, whereas what they really wanted to do was sail over the U-boats because by that stage in the war, when they met a U-boat, they sunk it.
Yes.
I mean, you can understand why they wanted to. So the game has changed and it has become more dangerous. Yeah. And of course, the other nice thing about the final section is you finally meet the enemy.
Yes. Yes.
And actually, I think there is a point which I missed both times when I was sort of reading people writing about it, the bit where they're looking at all of these U-boats at the end of the war that have just popped up and they're saying, we only sunk two. And they can clearly see more than two in front of them. She's not so dumb. There are women in this film.
There are.
I mean, the second woman we see in the film is dead, it has to be said.
That's very much in keeping with the themes of the film.
Well, so Virginia McKenna, this is her breakthrough role.
Yeah.
She goes on to be Born Free Lady. And you can see, I mean, she just does just light up the film. It's one of these things where if a film says, my goodness, there's a beautiful Wren, when you see that character, they've sort of got to deliver on that promise.
Yes.
And she completely does. Mrs. Denham Elliott.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there's quite a bleak view of womankind in this film.
But surprising amount of female characters for a 1953 film.
Yes.
1953 war film. And especially one about the Navy. It would have been it would have been perfectly possible to do this with no female characters.
Yeah, although there are fewer than there are in Which We Serve. I mean, In Which We Serve is a home front, war front.
All the riveting and all of that,
Whereas, I mean, this is mainly ship. But you're right, so one of the other scenes that I remember from childhood is the two sailors coming around the corner and seeing that the house has been bombed and realising what this means.
Yeah.
Again, going back to the film being bleaker, in the book, Virginia McKenna is killed.
Of course. No, of course.
He falls in love.
It's not
he finds
really
hope,
moving up my to-read list.
So, your girl at home is either cheating on you
or dead.
Or dead.
Yeah.
As I say, I just feel he had quite a bleak war. The casualty list. I mean, I can't find a casualty list for the film, but do you have any sense of the Battle of the Atlantic's?
I don't have a number in head, actually. It's big, isn't it?
It's big. Right. So in the war in total, the Royal Navy lost just over 50,000 men in action and another 800 men missing in action. And again, if you read The Cruel Sea, you will find out what happened to those men.
Yeah.
And the Wrens lost 102 killed.
Yeah.
So in the Battle of the Atlantic, and I suspect, let's assume these figures are sort of representative, there are 36,000 Royal Navy sailors killed and 36,000 Merchant Navy sailors killed. 3,500 merchant vessels sunk.
Yeah.
On the other side, the Nazis lost 30,000 U-boat sailors and 783 submarines.
Yeah.
Just the sheer scale of all of it. So, the Navy lost 175 warships in World War II and still had a Navy.
Yes. 700 U-boats is, I mean, lots of those would have just been sort of lost to accidents as well. I mean, they weren't particularly well-engineered for going out into the middle of the Atlantic and back in bad weather.
Yeah, especially when you're sort of, when you're churning them out.
Yeah.
The Cooler King Award for the most gratuitous American character, a completely American-free film.
Yeah.
I mean, in the book, they stay in New York for 2 months.
Do they?
Yeah, they have a refit.
That must be nice for them.
Yeah.
I think
you get the impression it rather was. He's bought it. Sarge, the best death? I think it's only the men with the depth charge,
or it's the men
after the sinking of the Compass Rose.
Yeah, I think it's the death charge.
I think it's the death charge because that
gives
is
the
that
emotional
is
a, heft to.
In terms of memes, I mean, I wouldn't mind having Virginia McKenna looking at Donald Sinden and saying, after telling him to be careful, saying, "You see, I know where you're going." Which is a kind of doom moment.
might be the attempted sort of sing-along to
I
can imagine when I would use that when I'm in sort of in periods of enforced jovility.
Actually, Jack Hawkins doing his quiz would be good. I was going to say any memes of Jack Hawkins looking stern and manly, but actually Jack Hawkins' quiz would be quite good as well. Tough next category. Stiffest upper lip.
Oh, well, it's a film of stiff upper lips.
That's
isn't it?
Literally I've got written here.
Yeah, it's literally. I think you're going to enter the rare shared award between about half the cast.
So I think we have to give a special mention to the coxswain and the chief learning of Gladys's death.
Yeah.
I
mean, it's probably Hawkins, isn't it? It's probably Hawkins overall, but.
Yeah.
It's tough.
I mean, he just gets more stiff upper lip time than anyone else. Yeah. But actually, I feel like that's an archetypal sort of British war movie shot of your sister/fiance has just died.
Yeah.
Cut to man's face immobile.
Yeah.
And someone comforting him by telling them that she was the victim of a direct hit, so it would have been very quick.
Yeah. All of those shots in the more recent Nolan Dunkirk of Kenneth Branagh in naval uniform standing on the mole in Dunkirk staring at it. They're all just shots from this film, basically. There's Kenneth Branagh in it.
Latter-day Jack Hawkins. Yeah. I would also give you Virginia McKenna learning that Compass Rose has been sunk.
Yeah.
Where, again, it's really interesting. No one offers her any comfort.
Yes.
The officer says, "You knew someone on that, didn't you?"
Yeah.
And she says, "Yes." You know, and there's no, "Well, look, why don't you go and go and take 5 minutes? It's a cup of tea, have a sit down."
It's going to happen again. You know what I mean? Yeah.
This is how we won, you know. I think the other side were fairly heartless. Speaking of, brings us to the nastiest Nazi. I mean,
it's the sea, isn't it?
It's the sea.
It's almost at the beginning.
It's the cruel sea, The sort of, I mean, the only Nazis we meet are all perfectly nice.
Yeah, it's the end of the war.
Dan Buster's dog prize for the most problematic moment. I mean, I think you'd probably write more interesting women.
You probably would.
These days, but they're not one dimensional. There are at least two dimensions.
They're at least two dimensionals, I'd say.
Yeah.
Not quite fully formed, but.
Yeah. Killing the men in the water is obviously deeply problematic, but that's literally the point.
Yes, exactly.
And in terms of, I mean, loose lips, the one that has stayed with me actually is a lot of them are for Hawkins's narration.
Mm-hmm.
So for us, the Battle of the Atlantic was becoming a private war. If you were in it, you knew all about it, which I think is sort of the point of the book and the film.
Yes,
is here was this thing.
Yeah,
and it was odd. And again, it comes through in the one of the things in the book is he talks about how odd it was that the worst thing to be on was an oil tanker.
Yeah, because if it gets hit.
Just goes up and you've got no chance.
Yeah.
But he said the crews who got off oil tankers all immediately volunteered to be on oil tankers again. And there's all of this just stuff that you just think is weird.
Yeah.
You know, why would you do that? But yes, at some level, if you were in it, you knew all about it. How to go without sleep, how to bury the dead, and how to die without wasting anyone's time.
Yes.
He snarled. So, I mean, there are no completely implausible moments.
No,
I think we sort of assume that basically pretty much all of this happened.
Yeah.
There are no war crimes, I think.
Well. Okay, there is an argument that the very act of torpedoing a merchant ship is a war crime.
Right, go on.
Very, very quickly. When the submarine is first sort of invented in the very early 20th century for military uses, you know, the idea is they could fire torpedoes from under the water. I always find this really striking, sort of before the First World War, this sort of moment of innocence, that the belief is they will be excellent for sort of coastal defence and attacking an enemy battle if it's approaching your harbours, but absolutely dreadful at taking on enemy merchant vessels, because by the time they've surfaced... gotten everyone off the merchant ship.
Oh, right, of course, yes.
Sunk the empty merchant ship and then gone away, the opposing navy will have intervened. The idea that you would torpedo a civilian vessel, killing civilians on board without any warning, just seen as absolutely just not going to happen. A civilized navy is not going to do this. And it's only when the First World War gets going that you slip towards this. And then Second World War, it's expected from the start. But you are entitled to sink enemy merchant shipping. You probably, given the rules of war, should give them fair warning and should give the crew a chance to evacuate before you sink them, which doesn't happen in the air. And British submarines sink German merchant shipping as well. And, Americans and Japanese sink each other's. You know, everyone's doing it, but could argue it's a war crime.
Right.
There we go. Minor rant over.
Duncan. Is this the operation that changed the course of World War II?
Well, it's an important aspect of the war. It's a really important aspect of the war for Britain. If Britain loses the Battle of the Atlantic, it's hard to see how Britain can continue its war effort because, Britain's this really globalised economy. It relies on, food, it relies on fuel, it relies on all this stuff coming in from all around the world. Food from South America, food from North America, North American oil, food from as far away as Australia and New Zealand. And this is the whole point. They're trying to suffocate Britain's economy and Britain's ability to sustain its war effort and feed its people. So, it's a really, I think when you read Churchill, it's the moments in the war he thinks of, the most sort of like dicey and perilous. It's the fall of France, it's the fall of Singapore to the Japanese, and it's these moments in the Battle of the Atlantic when it looks like the noose is tightening too much.
Worth Dying For.
That was a great film.
It is a great film. I like you watched it twice in the space of fortnight, and it's great.
Yeah, I'm probably not going to watch it a third time in the space of 3 weeks, but I will happily watch it again. It's a great film.
Yeah. That was The Cruel Sea. Next week, it's Christmas and we're behind the wire at Stalag 17.